This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Many Americans know Madagascar primarily from the animated movie of the same name. A population of varied types of lemurs features prominently in the film. They're led by the selfish and silly King Julian and endlessly pursued by the Fusa.
Presenting your royal highness, the illustrious blah, 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 you know, et cetera, et cetera. Hooray, let's go.
Now, everybody, we all have great curiosity about our guests, the New York Giants. Yes, Willie.
I like them.
I like them, I like them, I like them first. Before I even met them, I liked them.
Yes,
I saw
yes,
them, I liked them right
yes.
Away. You hate them compared to how much I like
shut
them.
Shut up, you're so annoying. Now, for as long as we can remember, we have been attacked and eaten by the dreaded Fusa.
The Fusa! The Fusa are attacking!
Come on, y'all are not attacking us this very instant.
Turns out the Fusa are real animals, strange little cat-like predators, more closely related actually to the mongoose family. And all those different lemurs, well, that's pretty realistic too. And that's only a small slice of the unusual diversity of life found on the island of Madagascar. In fact, the island is home to more unique species than anywhere else on Earth. It's also one of the poorest nations in the world. Native forests have been decimated, climate change is taking a toll, and there are few resources for either research or conservation. Joining me now in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Yoder. She's professor in the departments of biology and evolutionary anthropology at Duke University and also director of the Duke Lemur Center. She studies the lemurs of Madagascar and is here in Woods Hole this summer teaching a course in evolutionary biology. Also, Sal Sergio, he's a visiting scientist with the New England Aquarium and a guest investigator at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He's surveyed the diversity of marine mammals around Madagascar and recorded the first field observations of a previously unconfirmed whale species called Omura's whale. And finally, Mananzu Jonasson. She lived in Madagascar until she was 23. She holds master's degrees in marine biology and environmental science from the University of Plymouth in England and SUNY Brockport, respectively. But when she returned to Madagascar, there were no permanent jobs for her. She's been living in Falmouth since 2009 and is co-founder of Madagascar Botanicals, a local business selling Malagasy-made products. Welcome to Living Lab, all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We're happy to be here.
Mananzu, there's one key difference with the movie Madagascar, and that is that there are no people in the movie. And of course, there are almost 23 million people in the real Madagascar. Poverty is pervasive. What was life there like for you growing up?
It was a mix of I grew up going to the coast, and I saw the primary forest as probably Anissa knows it. Along the way to the east coast, it was covered by primary forest. So as I grew up, I saw it being degraded and disappearing very fast. But apart from that, we had a pretty basic, nice life in a city. The main problem, I feel like we've always been fighting politically, that it has never been stable. I remember as far as I was like in the fourth grade, we were always, I've been through three coup d'etat. I've been through three almost civil wars, and I've been through bombs and gunshots in the city. So it as much as it was a beautiful, it is still a beautiful country, it still has that feeling of instability, economical uncertainties and political directions that we're not quite sure of.
And can you give us a sense just of the landscape of Madagascar and what it looks like?
What it looks like right now, if you arrive on a plane as you land in the capital city of Antananarivo, the soil will be bare. It makes you cry. It makes you cry because there's nothing left. And there's the phenomenon known as lavic, which means holes, because the soil's been so degraded that it just flashes down to the river. And there's nothing left. I was there in September. It was a season of a slash and burn, which pretty much means the farmers burn the land so that they have more land for pasture for their cows, but they go farther and farther. So I went there during the season of slash and burn, and the entire island was 100% covered with smoke. It was hard to breathe. We thought going to the coast would be better, but no. We were flying above Nosy Be, actually, and we just were under a thick cloud the whole time.
And you fell in love with Madagascar early in your education and your career. What makes Madagascar so special in terms of biodiversity and wildlife?
Well, it's an amazing place, as you've been hearing. It's been isolated from the rest of the world for at least 88 million years. So most of the plants and animals that are there sort of washed ashore, accidentally over time. And then they've taken root and turned into these fantastic forms. So as I like to say, when you're out in the forest, you can say, well, there's a tree. I know that's a tree. I don't know what kind of tree it is. There's a lizard. It's a, you know, clearly a lizard, but it's a lizard you've never seen before, and so on. And so that's how it is for all of the biota of Madagascar. So that's why, as biologists, we're so concerned about protecting it, because once it's gone, it is gone. And it's taken, 90 million years of evolutionary development to arrive at the very special place that it is.
I mean, 80% of the species that are there are found nowhere else on Earth.
Nowhere else. And that includes everything, plants, animals. If you're talking about mammals and vertebrates, for the mammals, they're 100% unique to Madagascar. So that's the lemurs and the tenrex and the rodents and the carnivores are unique to Madagascar, those particular kinds, like the fusa that we were hearing about.
Right. I mean, so the fusa, I guess it hadn't occurred to me to think whether or not they were real animals. And it wasn't until one of my kids mm-hmm. came to me having watched a Wildcrats show and said, Mama, the fusa are real.
They certainly are real. They're beautiful animals. I think they're done a disservice in the movies Madagascar. They're quite elegant, really. I mean, they do hunt lemurs. They're very effective predators on lemurs, but they're quite lovely, very small and compact, and unlike any carnivore you've ever seen, very sleek.
I mean, that's one of the things with all of these mammals. You've got, lemurs or tenrex, things that elsewhere there might be a species or two, and we think of lemurs as being closely related to monkeys, but they take on all of these different forms in Madagascar. They look like mice and monkeys and all these other different things.
Well, they have evolved into very different and specialized niches, which is what brought my fascination to it. And I guess the eye is the classic example of just an animal that you can't even imagine. Right. It's like the Dr. Seuss animal. They have these very long tapping fingers, and they have ever-growing rodent-like incisors and big bat-like ears, and these are primates. And there's nothing like the eye other than the eye.
So one thing that doesn't exactly come through in that little clip from Madagascar is this fusa not only being such a special animal as all of the mammals, but their vulnerability and how endangered they are. And that's something that I think needs to really be emphasized as we're talking about pretty much everything, and particularly the terrestrial species of Madagascar, a high level of endemism, high level of vulnerability, high level of numbers of endangered species.
Right. Well, the hottest biodiversity hotspot, as we like to refer to it, and a biodiversity hotspot is a place like Sal was describing where the biota are unique to that place and they're highly threatened. And as Mananzu was describing, the forests are disappearing before our eyes. And certainly my first trip to Madagascar was in 1986, and I've seen forest degradation of extreme form, just in my lifetime.
I mean, I was reading something the other day, said only 10% of Madagascar's mm-hmm. native forest remains at this point. Mananzu, is your sense that the people of Madagascar know how special their island is in terms of biodiversity? Is that on people's radar? Or is it just, familiarity breeds contempt, right? Is this just what life is like?
As I sit here and actually listen to Anne and Sal and you, it makes me feel like you come there and value the resources Like, I'm sitting here and listening, like, you really come from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. If I was there right now, I'm trying to be at the person in Madagascar right now, trying to find my food of yesterday, which, because mm-hmm. I haven't eaten yesterday, I really don't care what lemurs are
exactly.
doing. I really don't care if the trees are burning. So I'm sitting here and I say, okay, you know, this forest will be great for my generation 50 years from now, but I haven't eaten in 2 days. So I need that tree right now to make charcoal for so mm-hmm. I can cook. There's been a really, really recrudescence of lemur hunting lately, and that's because they have no food. Absolutely no food because of the political and economic situation. So as much as we love lemurs from this perspective, an evolutionary perspective, those people will not survive another year if they don't eat. So it's a big, big challenge and dilemma of what goes first.
Yeah, if I can jump in, and that's what I say when I'm talking to people about, you know, well, how can I help, you know, address this crisis? And I say, well, to make life better for the lemurs, you need first to make life better for the Malagasy people.
Oh, I totally agree with that.
Because
completely.
It's when it comes to a choice between feeding your children or saving the tree, I think, you know,
we all know where the choice would go.
Yeah, right. It's a pretty easy choice to make.
This is really a profound difference between the mindsets of people living in developing or underdeveloped countries like Madagascar and people living in developed Western countries like the United States. And, you know, there's something I would add to that. I work with a number of highly educated middle-class Malagash who have a somewhat different perspective, a middle perspective from the people that are the majority of the people that are in incredible poverty. And there was one fairly profound moment I had with my team. It was three students sitting around talking about, okay, what can we do? What can we do for Madagascar? What are you going to do for Madagascar? And it was a really tragic moment for me because their attitude was pretty hopeless. They really felt like they didn't know what they could do. Being Malagasy in Madagascar and the people that actually had the most potential for making change, they really didn't feel like they didn't see a path by which they can make change.
Manantu, you earned the opportunity to go abroad, earned, as we said before, two different master's degrees, one in England, one in the United States, went back to Madagascar to try to put that to use. And then you were working with the conservation group Wildlife Conservation Society and had an experience in 2009 as a conservation contractor that apparently was a turning point for you and your attitude about whether or not you could continue to try to work in Madagascar. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, and that falls really nicely, actually, with what Sal just said. I went to Mananar, a barrage, which both of you know, it's inaccessible. It took us 3 days just to get there by road, going through rivers and sands and dunes. And it's really remote, but it's also a UNESCO biosphere reserve. It's listed as one of the natural heritages of UNESCO. And we were there in 2009, right in the middle of the crisis when the coup d'etat happened. And I went there and we were there as part of the team to see what UNESCO and the National Park Agency have achieved in a few years. And I'm sitting there with our team trying to talk to the villagers, like, literally is a pen and paper. So let us tell me how we did in the last 5 years and where you see yourself or what can we do better. And right across from us, there's a truck with armed men from the army. So these are official people loading rosewood from the forest. And they pay the villagers about $5, I think at most, to go out in the forest, cut down those trees by hand. They hurt. I mean, this. I went in the forest. It took us 7 hours to get in. And they drag the wood out of the piece of wood out of the forest, to load them onto the truck, who then carries them onto the river and then out of the country. And they're armed. They have guns. And I'm sitting there and like, I don't think my little pen and paper is going to work. I don't have $5 to give to the people who need it right now. And I definitely don't want to argue with the big truck with armed men to say, hey, stop the log, illegal logging, because the trees are going to be good for you 10 years from now. So that was 2009, and I haven't worked in conservation since, because I did not know where that was going.
That's Mananzu Jonasson. Also with me, Ann Yoder of Duke University and Sal Sergio of New England Aquarium and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. I'm Heather Goldstone. We invite you to join our conversation. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Madagascar is home to a wealth of rare and unique species, but it's also one of the poorest nations on Earth. We're talking this hour about the challenges that juxtaposition creates. My guests are Sal Sergio, a visiting scientist with the New England Aquarium and a guest investigator at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Ann Yoder. She's a professor in the departments of biology and biological anthropology and anatomy at Duke University, and also director of the Duke Primate Center. And Mananzu Jonasson, she's a Malagasy expat living in Falmouth and co-founder of Madagascar Botanicals. And as we were saying before the break, 10% of the native forest is all that's left in Madagascar. I mean, counting up deforestation, relatively easy. We can look from a satellite and see the forest is gone. What does that mean in terms of mammalian or other plant and animal diversity? Do we even have a handle on how much that has declined as the forest has been cut down?
I'm not sure that I am the one to answer that question. Certainly people, my colleagues, are going out and doing biodiversity inventories on a regular basis. But I think you can just do the math and say when forest disappears, their residents disappear, and there's some movement of populations into marginal habitat that can, you know, buy them a little bit of time. But ultimately, as the forest disappears, so does the biota. I do want to address, you know, I think, some hope. And, you know, I'm a glass half full kind of person. And there are a lot of organizations that are invested in trying to help make Malagasy lives better and, by, you know, association, improve the situation with the forest. At the Duke Lemur Center, actually, we've changed our name, so we're the Duke Lemur Center now. We have a conservation initiative that's very much community-based, where we're working with local people in the northeastern part of the island to help them find alternative protein sources, for example, fish farming, because as we've mentioned, with the deforestation, and as Mananzu mentioned, there's been an extreme increase in the amount of lemur hunting for protein sources, because that's really the only option. So if you have alternative protein sources, that's a solution right there. That's really a long-term sustainable solution. And it also brings livelihood to the fish farmers. So that's something that we're doing. We're also working in collaboration with various organizations to reforest and even forest restoration. So there are many places in Madagascar where people are on the ground and working with the Malagasy people to try to improve the situation. That said, as we the continuing theme that we keep hitting on is it's a very, very poor place, and there just aren't alternatives for the people who want to make a living. So that's the essential tension. And until we can improve the economic situation and the political stability, which I think will follow with the economic stabilization, you know, it is a race against the clock.
You mentioned fish farming, and Sal, a lot of the work that you've done in Madagascar, and Mananzu, you've also been involved in this kind of work, is actually surveying the diversity of marine life around Madagascar. How much do we know about ocean biodiversity? Is there, that part of the ocean hasn't been isolated the way the island of Madagascar has, but is there a similar biodiversity hotspot in the ocean there?
So my focus of my career is marine mammals, so I can really only speak to marine mammals. And what is fascinating about Madagascar And really exciting from a research perspective is how little is known about vast areas and communities of animals like cetaceans, whales, and dolphins. And when I started working there 12 years ago, I joined a project that had been focused in one small region for 10 years in the Northeast in Entangil Bay. It's where I met Manitsu, actually. And after that, I shifted the effort to the west coast of Madagascar, where there had been virtually no work on cetacean communities. And we learned just every day you go out, every season that you, you know, execute, you learn new things. And it ultimately led to discovery of a species that had never been observed before. And that I think is a real poster child for what, you know, what can be discovered. It's like I tend to refer to it as frontier science, going where people haven't really looked before, and you find things that can be crazy exciting.
I mean, key example, you last year published the first field observations of a whale species that nobody had ever seen before.
And wasn't supposed to be in this part of the world. The range was restricted to the western Pacific and far eastern Indian Ocean. And then suddenly we found them in the Mozambique Channel, which is known as already established as a diversity hotspot for cetaceans, and you know, just not very well surveyed, particularly along the coast of Madagascar.
And do marine mammals around Madagascar face some of the same threats, the same pressures from the people who live there?
Particularly on the coast, yes. So there's one particular group of people in the southwest of Madagascar that practice dolphin hunting, and their maritime culture that live off the marine resources. And probably 20, 30, 50 years ago, their impact on dolphin populations was minimal. But as the populations grow and techniques change, monofilament nets were introduced in the 80s. A drive hunt tradition developed in over the last 20 years of the 20th century, and that has had a fairly profound impact on coastal dolphin, and particularly coastal dolphins, which are very vulnerable because they're obligatory to the coasts.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about the threats facing the amazing biodiversity of Madagascar and efforts to build more science and conservation capacity there. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Now, as we're talking about these human pressures, and as we've said, absolutely no judgment here, the choices that people in Madagascar are facing are unimaginably hard. But it's not only these direct human pressures. Madagascar is starting to feel the impacts of climate change as well. Heavy rains last year flooded 60% of the capital city, destroyed crops in the north, but then there was no rain in the south. Already half the population doesn't have access to clean water, and climate change is just making that worse. Mononzo, you still have family and friends in Madagascar. Are they seeing changes? And you've been back. Are you seeing changes in the weather patterns that are just exacerbating all the problems that we've already talked about?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I'm the only one here of my entire family, so I'm the castaway. Yes, there absolutely. In the south, which is a dry area by nature anyway, the hunger has been extreme. I think the last season has been so bad that it was so dry. They only rely on cactus and desert plants for food anyway. So now with very little rain, very little humidity, they don't even have that. So that when we see reports of that, you just don't know where do you start? How are you going to address this? And also, we talked about earlier in the mainland, and you mentioned in the city, it's flooded not because it's a valley, the water should go somewhere, but they built really, really big industrial size buildings in the aquifers because there's no regulations. You go out there and you bribe the people in power and you build right there. But they didn't realize that they were covering the water where the drainage should go. So that's why the city got completely flooded, because they covered the rice field and the water just stagnated there completely. And also in the where my ancestors are from, I went there with my, I brought my son there to see, my family owns a huge piece of land in the middle of nowhere. So I brought him there to see it. And we met with the villagers, and they had actually have this picture on my website. They had these roots, tiny little roots of sweet potatoes. They were so small, and that was all they had for food because there was no rain. The water, the river dried up. And I was like, Igor, what is that all you going to eat? I said, yep, there's no rain. It's been dry for months. So it is physically, you can see it. Like, you don't need data for this. You go out there and you know it's changing, or they know it's changing. They've lived there all their lives.
We talked about the movie Madagascar, a little lighthearted introduction. But, you know, it was hoped, I guess, by some that movie might boost tourism, would increase interest in Madagascar. And that didn't really come to fruition. What happened? I guess it was as a result of the political situation.
Yes, it was. Madagascar, the movie, not the island, was a long process. It took about 10 years between Wildlife Conservation Society, Conservation International, the big names to put together back then, in the, like early 2000s, to attract tourists to Madagascar, kind of like what the Lion King did to the safari tourist in Africa. But then there was a coup d'etat. So everything collapsed. Your entire effort of 10 years just collapsed. And it doesn't really work since, because we've really high crime rates now. I mean, we don't get me wrong. You can go out there and visit as long as you're reasonable in what you bring out on the streets. Like, don't show off your latest iPhone or hey, have all this money. You can definitely travel there. But as far as big mass tourists that the movie was expecting to get, no, that didn't happen because of the coup, the instability, the economic situation. And the airlines, I'm sure.
Yes,
both
I was
of
going
you
to
know.
Say infrastructure is certainly part of the problem.
The planes can sometimes take off or never, and they won't even tell you. So that right there, it's a challenge for tourists to come and visit. Yeah.
And that's the continuing situation at this point. I mean, how does that political situation and that infrastructure situation, Anne and Sal, you're both sitting here like rolling your eyes. How does that political and infrastructure situation impact your ability to do research in Madagascar?
Well, it definitely brings challenges to the table. Certainly, you never want to go as a Western researcher with an agenda and spend less than a month there, because you might stay in Tana for 2 weeks getting your permits and you know, just working your way through the system, and or Air Madagascar might be on strike, or you know, the jeep that you thought you had arranged to take you out into the field, their brother might need it instead.
And this exactly happened to me in 2015. I got there and had a travel itinerary that took me to three different corners of Madagascar, and I always got on one flight to the south, to the extreme south in Toliara, and then Madagascar went on strike, and I ended up having to go back to the capital by truck, and then from the capital to Nosy Be by truck, and then back to the capital by truck. And people who know what Madagascar is like can, you know, they know what an incredible adventure that was.
That's not a quick, easy trip.
No, it was actually kind of cool, because I got to see Madagascar in ways that I hadn't since I'd first been there, when I did travel around quite a bit by land. But it's incredibly challenging. Yeah, and you do, when you're a Western scientist going to anywhere in Africa, really, and Madagascar is one example, the first thing you do is adjust your expectations and learn how to work in that
Mora.
Yeah, mora, which is easy,
take it slow.
Yeah.
I wonder when you're trying to get funding to do that research, I mean, you must have to adjust your budget for the fact it's going to have to be a longer trip. You're going to have to do things differently. You're going to have to be much more flexible. Are funding agencies at all understanding of that reality?
It depends on your reviewers, of course, and all of us at the table understand how that peer review goes. So if your reviewer has any clue about the realities of the situation, certainly they expect to see that. And if you haven't worked it into your budget, they will red flag it. But I do want to shift the conversation just a bit. We're making Madagascar sound like it's a place you would never want to go. It's magnificent.
Right.
It's just one of the most incredible places. It is the most incredible place I've been, and it is beautiful, even despite all of these problems and tragedies that we're describing. There is nothing like being in the forest in Madagascar or on the coast or in the city. It's really...
Thank you for saying that. I wanted to point this out earlier. For all of the issues with the coup... poverty, some safety issues. I actually, ironically, find Madagascar to be a very safe place to work and to go, particularly compared to a lot of other African nations. I find even with the challenges, I find Madagascar to be quite an easy place to work because maybe it's just because I've become familiar with it, but I never feel personally really at risk. And you learn a sense of what to do and what not to do, but I whenever I hear a lot of concern about safety, particularly for tourists, I feel like it's way overblown.
It is a little bit, and it's common sense.
I mean, I have to say my own parents sailed around the world, arrived home several years ago, and they went to Madagascar, to Nosy Bay, to see the sea turtle sanctuary there, and absolutely loved it. No concerns. Now, of course, that's an unusual form of tourism. They arrived on their own boat and they stayed on their own boat.
Nosy Sakatia. It's not many people know about. I'm pretty sure what you're talking about is Nosy Sakatia. Not quite a sanctuary, but it's a remarkable place for turtles. Yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking about the threats facing the amazing biodiversity of Madagascar and, of course, the amazing biodiversity of Madagascar. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this hour are Mananzu Jonasan, a Malagasy expat living in Falmouth since 2009 and now co-founder of Madagascar Botanicals, evolutionary biologist and lemur expert Ann Yoder of Duke University and Duke Lemur Center, and marine mammal researcher Sal Sergio of New England Aquarium and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We invite you to join our conversation as well. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. We've talked a lot about the challenges, the problems, the deforestation, poverty, hunting, climate change, political instability, economic instability, and yet all three of you remain optimistic, I guess, about prospects for moving forward in Madagascar. And Sal and Anne, both of you work extensively with local teams. How do you go about finding your local collaborators?
Well, I can jump in with that. So I've been involved with Madagascar for decades now, and I've built a network sort of just organically over time. But I have a colleague, Steve Goodman, who is an American, but he lives in Madagascar and has for decades. And he established a program very early on called the Ecology Training Program for Malagasy students interested in evolutionary biology and ecology and conservation. And he just was able to identify all these amazing, bright Malagasy, you know, scientists in training. So he has been my, he's introduced me to all of these incredible students. And so what I have seen over time, which is one reason why I have cautious optimism, is I have seen young persons who really, you know, grew up in villages and didn't speak English. They spoke French, some French, and Malagasy, of course. But over the time that I've been working with them, I've seen them evolve into these very sophisticated knowledgeable scientists, and they are very much invested in trying to address all the problems that we've been discussing. And there is an organization called Vahatra, which means root in Madagascar, and it is Malagasy science by Malagasy scientists. And this has been a successful organization, and they are out working with local villagers and, you know, as we discussed a little while ago, do the people of Madagascar understand just what they have, the biological treasure that they steward? And the sort of short answer is no, but that is changing, and partly and largely by Malagasy trainees who are going out and working with the Malagasy.
So I work with two different marine institutions in Madagascar, IHSM in the south and CNRO in the north. And I've had the privilege of working with students from particularly IHSM, which is kind of like the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute of Madagascar. And I have really, it's been a big part of my work to focus on helping young students and Malagasy scientists come into a position where they can start making change, hopefully. One thing I've noticed, I've worked with people sort of bridging the generations from people my age in their late 40s, early 50s, and then young students in their 20s and 30s. And I've seen quite a dramatic change in the mindsets of these different generations And what I really see in the young generation, people that grew up with technology, unlike the older generation, they have a very different outlook on the world and a very different aptitude. And I think there is a lot of hope in finding those. My personal focus is try to find individuals that are the bright stars within the groups and put a lot of effort into developing their capacity and developing their future.
I mean, that builds individuals, but working one person at a time, how do you build that into more of a system? I mean, more of an actual, infrastructure and system for science and conservation.
I can speak a little to that, my specific experience and the Vahatra organization that I was just describing. This has been the efforts of Steve Goodman and a very, very talented, brilliant Malagasy man, Ashil Rasilimanana, and together they formed this organization, which is now, training hundreds and hundreds of students. So it's not a small operation. Right. This really has impact. And they are the ones that are going out into the forest and measuring biodiversity loss and counting species and counting what is there and what has been lost. So these are essential data that policy makers will need to inform their decisions about which parts of Madagascar are most urgently in need of protection.
And I think in a place like Madagascar, individuals in the right positions in the right places can actually have quite an influence. I've worked with a man named Norbert Andriana Rivello, who was actually a student during his master's work in IHSM who revealed that the communities, the artisanal fishermen and communities in the southwest of Madagascar were hunting dolphins. It wasn't really known, the extent of which was not known before his work. And we worked very closely together for 10 years. He got his PhD at IHSM, and he's now a professor at IHSM. And he has students from both Toliar and Fort Tafan on both the southeast and southwest coast that he's now bringing the message to. And I feel like that is the way for the future to move.
Manansu, you went abroad for your graduate education. Was that by necessity, or could you have stayed in Madagascar? Are those educational resources available?
It's both. I actually went to Chisholm. That's all I mentioned. That was my first college experience, which is short for the Marine Science Institute of Tulare. So I could have stayed there, but also I really wanted to have... It's an island. Madagascar is an island, so your perspectives can only go so far. So I really wanted to see what it's like out there. I think I'm the only one friend who said, I don't need to go out there, but if you live on the island, there's this urge to see what's out there, what's in the world. And it's not easy to get out of the island. I was the first one of my family to go study abroad. In fact, I was the first one to graduate from high school. So it's both by necessity to see what other people are doing out there, and also by... And it helped a lot. And then coming back, I say, okay, now I understand where these Westerners come from when they arrive here. So I can sort of bridge the gap between if I was just living there and this international conservation coming in, which, by the way, reminds me, early on, that's been corrected over the last decade, but early on, it was a top-down politics. Well, we are big organizations with a lot of $1 million, and we tell you what to do with your forest. So now I think of it, what if I come from Madagascar, arrive in Utoh, and I would tell you what to do with your water? So it's the same kind of thing. So over the years, it's been corrected. So going, studying overseas and meeting people helped me a lot in understanding that. So that's why now I sit here and I can understand both sides. I think if I didn't leave the country, I'd be still angry. Like, why are you telling me what to do? And at the same time, I'd be like, okay, you bring a lot of $1 billion, so I'll do whatever you say. So it helped a lot to go out.
Yes, I've always called that conservation colonialism. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of that. And it happily is changing and adjusting. But there was a lot of do as we say, not as we do. Mm-hmm.
What kind of reception do you get? I mean, you are working largely with Malagasy teams, but, you know, if you're talking to people, if you ever get the opportunity to talk to local people about your research, what kind of response do you get?
Well, it varies. I just have to say that one of the aspects of working in Madagascar that I most enjoy is working with Malagasy people, because as a culture, I find the Malagasy people to be incredibly generous and open-hearted and
happy.
Yes, it's a fun. It's fun. The parties are fantastic in the villages. So I get various reactions, and in the villages, there's a lot of innocence, really, I guess, mm-hmm. is the best way to describe it, that just don't know. Then there are the corrupt, politicians and, functionaries that are very difficult, that can make life very difficult. And then there are my academic colleagues who are fully colleagues, and that's, so there, you have to be flexible and responsive to who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm. Mananzu, how does your family feel about your decision to leave Madagascar?
Oh, they were fully supportive. I've always been a little wander lost anyway. Early on, I followed a camping trip outside in Andasi Bay with WWF. Back then, I was like 8 years old, so I knew I was going into this field early on. But just to follow up on what Anne said earlier, and I completely agree, who you talk to in Madagascar. On my little notes here, if you talk to a politician or anyone in the administrative circle, bring in a cultural translator. Do not try to go in by yourself. In fact, I can't even get out of the airport. I need help. That's how bad it is. Like they look at my passport, and I have a passport from the US and Madagascar, and then they will start saying, so... you have dollars, right? Before I let you out. So I say, no, I'm not going to give you dollars. Well, then we're going to look at each other here until someone gives in. So, and I'm from there. So I completely understand who you talk to. If you're in a bureaucracy, don't try to navigate it by yourself. It's going to be madness. In the villages, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's the most basic human nature life that you don't want to leave. You're like, this is how humanity should be.
Yes.
So there's that big difference of who you talk to.
Now, you've started a new business here in Falmouth to find a market for products made by Malagasy women. Tell us about that business. How's it going?
I'm really excited. We started the whole paperwork and everything in November when I came back from Madagascar. But I started selling July 4th, and I've sold already over 80 bags.
These are handbags that are made.
One of them. So they are handmade. They are natural materials. You all familiar with this? They are raffia, palm tree leaves on the outside, reed on the inside, and leather handle. So what I did was I opened an office here. I opened an office in Madagascar. My sister is in charge of talking to the woman there to weave them, and then they ship them to me, and then I sell them. And then I give 8% back to the community, so that now we work with the villagers to give basic necessities, such as shoes. You all know they walk to school with no shoes, drinking water, just basics. I have other projects in mind. Once we recoup our costs much later on, to have a street business school, because you know there's hundreds of, I would even say millions of children out there who go out on the street because they don't go to school. There's no such thing. So my idea is, like, we're going to create a small business school, like the way locals do it. Like, let's not try to copy what the Western people do, because it's not going to work there. But let's work how they are doing it and work with that system to make it happen.
And what you were all saying earlier, work on the economic situation first.
Yes.
Let the Malagasy people help themselves, and the conservation can come later, or come out of that, perhaps. Is that the model for what you're doing?
Absolutely. This is as basic as, if they have food, they will not need That's to right. go into forests or resources. It's as basic of that. They don't need to. In fact, they don't want to. If they have income and they have food, they will leave the forest alone. It's sacred. Most of you know that they have their medicinal plants from there. They have their burial sites there. They have their pirogues and boats from there. So it's sacred. So if they have food and income, they will not even need to go out there.
We talked earlier about this idea that you know, in some regards, talking about Madagascar as a biodiversity hotspot is a luxury of the Western world. And yet Madagascar is not maybe on a lot of people's radar. We have less than a minute, but Manzo, I wonder if you could kind of speak to the question of, why should people here in the United States care about what's going on in Madagascar?
Because it's not just a movie, and there's lovely people out there. And I'm sure both Saul and Anne love to work with the people there. It's just this amazing feeling of happiness and hope, and it's a nice place to live. And also, biodiversity-wise, in terms of marine organisms, we have not explored, I think, a tenth of what's out there, just because there's no resources. Conservation International did the rapid marine assessment back then, but it's so big, it's so large, there's still a lot to find out. And it's just an amazing place to go to. Like any other countries, it has its problems, but it's a glass half full.
It's very special.
Here.
Mananzu Jonasson and Yoder Salsertio, thank you all.
Thank you, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.